Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, February the 14th, day number 45 of 2013. So I guess we begin by saying Happy Valentine's Day to each and every one of you. Tonight we have a program about Valentine's Day, but we're going to combine Valentine's Day with history. And we're going to be looking at some of the great couples in world history, Cleopatra, Mark Antony, Juan Perón, Evita Perón. I mean, what an amazing lineup of people that we have tonight. In a quick second, we're going to get to Leslie Eastman, and she's going to give us an outlook of what to look forward to tonight. Thank you to the management of Blog Talk Radio for featuring our program tonight. That's always a good thing, and we thank you if you're listening to us for the first time, and we thank the management of Blog Talk Radio as well. So tonight we're going to do Valentine's Day and history. What an amazing combination that is. Our program tonight, this first segment, is brought to you by the book Cubanos in Wisconsin, which is a book that I just published. It's a story of our family coming to the United States. I think it's a very different book, and based on some of the reviews that we've been getting some wonderful reviews. And I think people like the idea that this is a story about family and freedom. I wrote the book because I wanted to thank my parents for bringing us to the United States and all of the courageous things that they did in getting out of Cuba. And, of course, I wrote it for my sons because I wanted my sons to know what it was like how I grew up and eventually came to the United States. So we thank all of you for buying the book, and many of you have sent me personal greetings through Facebook and some other means. Thank you very much. I'm glad that you've enjoyed the book so much. You can get it on Kindle now, by the way. We have the print and the Kindle version are both available as we speak. We just put up the Kindle version yesterday. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got Leslie Eastman, and she's got a big, big, big story about our show tonight. Let me say hello to Leslie Eastman. How are you, Leslie?
Happy Valentine's Day, Silvio.
Same to you. Are you dressed up as Cleopatra tonight? Is that the...
Well, I was going to say, when Cleopatra arrived in Tarsus, she was dressed in gold cloth as the goddess Venus. So I'm taking a page out of her book tonight, and you can envision me dressed in jewels and gold robes with a tiara on my head as the goddess Venus. And
all
how
right.
Appropriate for Valentine's Day.
Absolutely. So we're looking forward to imagining you tonight in that attire. Well, thank you for joining us tonight, as always. This is a really neat idea that you had about doing this show tonight, about mixing history and couples. But I've got a couple of quick things I want to get to before we hear from you. Number one, of course, today on this day in history, this was the day that St. Valentine was killed, I guess, back in 278 A.D. So that was a long time ago. But I have a question for you tonight, you being the goddess of capitalism. I have a question for you tonight on Valentine's Day. It's become very popular on TV commercials lately to see a guy propose to a girl, and he kneels down when he proposes to her. Where did that come from? I mean, that's obviously not a custom that I was familiar with.
Well, it's an intriguing question, Silvio. And as I did some research, it turns out that 76% of the men believe they should go down on bended knee to propose. So it's got a real solid tradition behind it. The origin, however, is unclear. But there's three acts that resemble this proposal approach. And they think it ties into one of these three acts. One is an act of faith, an act of religion, because people kneel during prayers. So while proposing, kneeling can have the same sort of signal as a connotation of a sign of respect, love, faith and hope. So that's one aspect. Another aspect is in the good old days when a lot of our chivalric traditions, and Barry will probably touch upon some of these tonight, came to pipes, you have royalty. And knights would kneel while being awarded honors from kings and queens. And so what could be the biggest honor for a man than receiving the acceptance of the woman of his heart?
Right.
So that's quite a big honor. So that's maybe why men propose on bended knee. And finally, and perhaps my favorite, it's a sign of surrender. Now, you know, you call it battle of the sexes. But really, when you surrender, you're committing yourselves to one another and surrendering yourself to being part of a couple. So that, too, has a very romantic connotation for this Valentine's Day.
Well, it really does, and it's a neat, it's a very interesting story that you just told us, because this has become very popular now, particularly you see it a lot in TV commercials. You know, you see a lot, you know, the commercials where, you know, guys are proposing and they're putting a ring in the girl or showing her the ring or whatever. It's become very popular, and I just didn't know the history behind it. I figured it had something to do with some of the things you mentioned. So thank you very much for explaining that very romantic gesture to us tonight on Valentine's Day.
Yes, I hope it was a good one for you.
I think it was. It was a great lesson. I was not familiar with all of those things that you said tonight. Now, we've got nine couples we're going to get into. Barry will be joining us in a few minutes, but we have nine couples, right?
I have a feeling we won't get to them all, but that's okay. I'd rather have too much than not enough. And,
right.
And there's so many fascinating ones we left on the cutting room floor, too. So looks like this is going to have to become a Valentine's Day tradition for us.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love this. I love this idea. I think it's a great idea. Now, the amazing thing, I was looking at your list, and the amazing thing is that these couples are from centuries, all across the centuries. Some of them as recent as, you know, the 1950s with Eva and Juan Perón, and some going back, many, many centuries. And then others, a couple of people like, Cortés and Malinche, a couple of people that I think I didn't think a lot of Americans knew that story. But that's it's a good one for a lot of people to hear.
Well, Sylvia, one thing I will say for you, I love history, but you've been a great and wonderful inspiration to explore South and Central American history. And so several of these couples are a homage to what you've brought to my life. And
it's
kind of my Valentine's Day gift to you.
All right. Well, you dressing up as Cleopatra is your Valentine's gifts for me. So we'll give each other those kinds of gifts tonight. But let's say hello to Barry. Barry, how you doing?
Happy Valentine's Day to both of you.
Barry, what are you wearing?
I am wearing all black. I'm the man in black today.
So you're like Johnny Cash tonight, huh?
Without the musical talent, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm kind of casual tonight. I hope I'm not a disappointment to you too, but I'm kind of casual tonight, not dressed up as anybody other than myself tonight, because I'm going to enjoy this program a great deal. So we're going to be looking at some of these couples tonight. And Leslie, who's the first one?
Well, when I began researching this, nearly every single list started off with Antony and Cleopatra. And how could I not start off our own show with a discussion of history's probably most dramatic and well-known romantic couple?
Yes.
Yet, as you explore their actual history, there's a question as to whether it was real romance or real politics that drove them. But in the end, I'd like to think it was a bit of both, especially, given their very famous dual suicide. So I'm just going to touch upon some of their relationship highlights, and then we'll go on to the next couple.
Yes.
And I think, though, Cleopatra did hook up with Julius Caesar very early on in her life, and Barry and I will be doing a show featuring Julius Caesar next month. Really, it's Antony and Cleopatra that inspires everybody. And while Cleopatra had indeed met Antony back when she was 14 and Antony was 28, when Antony helped her father regain his throne. And again, Cleopatra had known and interacted with Antony most likely while she was doing time in Rome, being the legendary mistress of Julius Caesar. It wasn't until her dramatic sailing into Tarsus to begin interacting and becoming a client queen of Antony as he began to rule the Eastern world in his triumvirate he formed with Octavian after Caesar's death, that they truly become the couple of legend. And there's so many aspects we could cover, but I think for me, perhaps the most dramatic one, and the one I loved from the Elizabeth Taylor movie, was when she sails into Tarsus to formally meet Antony the first time as a client queen and begin negotiations. And there's a passage from Plutarch that was later reworked by Shakespeare of how she sailed in this fantastic barge with the poop of gold and sails of purple and oars of silver, with musicians playing, incense, you know, being burnt from all the decks. She was dressed as the goddess Venus. Her little boys, very beautiful, were fanning her as the god Cupid. Her court women were dressed as mermaids. And this has got to have happened because it was so dramatically told with so much detail. And people went down to the docks to see this barge come in. And keep in mind, during this time, it was Hellenistic. And Cleopatra was doing Isis incarnate. In fact, in her own kingdom, she was Isis Aphrodite. And of course, Aphrodite translates to Venus in the Roman world. Meanwhile, Antony loved Greek things. He took on a lot of the Hellenistic characteristics, and in fact, that's pretty much why he connected with Cleopatra so well, and why eventually he was driven out of Rome and into civil war with Octavian and became so berated because he was so Hellenistic. He took on the aspects of the wine god Dionysus Bacchus, and he formed kind of a counterpart to her, Serapis Bacchus Dionysus. So he met her. They had a fabulous time on her barge. Next day, he comes over. She comes over to his place. He invites her to supper, and he's constantly joking about how mean and how poor he is. And at that point, they connected. He sailed over to Egypt. And unlike the other client kings he visited, when he went over to Egypt, he did not wear his court attire. He did not wear his, you know, Roman robes of honor. He dressed very simply as a Greek. So he came for the first time to Egypt as a very much private citizen, enjoyed the delights of her court. Well, needless to say, back in Rome, Octavian, beating the better politician, schemed, eventually tried to usurp the power, which led Antony's wife at the time, Fulvia, and his brother to have a mini civil war, which sadly they lost. Fulvia died, and Antony had to sail out of Egypt back to solve the problems, leaving Cleopatra at that time pregnant with the twins she would give birth to, Cleopatra Selene and Alexandra Helios. Well, Antony marries Octavia. The triumvirate is re-strengthened, and Antony decides he needs to go on an expedition to Parthia to conquer the rest of Alexander's old empire that wasn't in Roman clutches at the time. And again, because it was in the east and he really wanted to embrace Alexander's tradition, this seemed like a fine idea. So running out of money, and he goes back to Cleopatra. They reconnect, and subsequently, to help bond Cleopatra to him, he makes the famous donations, which gives Cleopatra the right to rule over the vast Eastern Empire that subsequently Antony was in control of. Now, in Rome, there was a tradition of ruling through client kings. So really, this was normally no big deal. However, it was dramatically done. It suited Octavian to play this up Cleopatra was getting all these lands because she was Antony's girlfriend, and it didn't look so very good. Well, in the end, Antony went on the Parthian campaign. It didn't go very well, and as a result of a few other things, Antony decides to divorce Octavia and marry Cleopatra in the Egyptian tradition, giving at that point Octavian a great excuse to pull out this will. Whether it's fake or not, that's completely under debate, but a will was produced that said Antony wanted to be buried when he died in his beloved Alexandria. Well, that's all the Romans really needed to once again go into this massive civil war, target Cleopatra and her empire. Ultimately, there was a big battle called Actium that's very famous. Sadly, Antony did not prove to be a great admiral, though I think and sense, based on a variety of factors, that Cleopatra and Antony agreed that Cleopatra would head back to Egypt with the treasure ship. So Antony acted as a diversion, got them back to Egypt. But again, there was not enough troops and not enough support, and ultimately Octavian was able to enter into Egypt and conquer it. In terms of their deaths, it is, of course, known that Antony did commit suicide, and it's thought that he believed Cleopatra was dead because of a letter indicating she was in the last place on earth to look her tomb. I suspect, knowing the Ptolemaic thinking and the fact that Cleopatra's ultimate goal was to keep on with her dynasty and to make sure her son ruled after her and maybe also to keep herself alive, she knew that Antony was a bit of a depressive, so she staged this knowing that he'd probably kill himself. Indeed, he did. Octavian enters into Alexandria. Cleopatra tries to negotiate with him and finds out that Octavian is in no mood to either maintain her on her throne or keep her son on the throne. And she ends up following Antony in death. I am going to be presenting a book to you as soon as I read it called The Murder of Cleopatra. There's some theories that she was murdered. However, in my romantic heart, I'd like to think that their love was based on some sort of passion, and given that the fact that she just lost her kingdom and the love of her life, that death seemed a bit more appealing. And though they don't know exactly what killed her, it could be poison or could have been a bite from a snake. Indeed, she did join Antony in death in a very immortal, and it essentially became immortalized as lovers again, that set the standard for romantic couples, as I noted before. They topped the list of any list of romantic couples I came across.
You're exactly right, and Cleopatra also had the good fortune of having Elizabeth Taylor play her part.
Well, you know, Sylvia, as I point out, that each generation seems to have a different take and a different vision
sure.
of Cleopatra. And for the 1960s, Elizabeth Taylor, to me, will be the penultimate Cleopatra. But Barry will point out he adores the Claudette Colbert version that was done in the 30s. There was a Theda Bara version. And I guess in the upcoming year or two, we can look forward to an Angelina Jolie version. So.
Yes, I understand that's coming. Yeah, there's also another one. I may have sent you a YouTube about that one. There's another one that was made of Cleopatra, too, where some young actress was playing her, a very pretty young actress. So, but you're right. I think they are probably the romance that, you know, if you're going to talk about great couples on Valentine's Day, you can't think of a better one than Antony and Cleopatra. That's a good choice, Leslie.
Yeah, so I figured I'd top off that. And
yes.
Then my next couple, and it's an homage to you, Silvio.
All right.
It's Isabella and Ferdinand, another royal couple. But this was a more traditional marriage, a marriage of Catholic monarchs. So
yes.
What can you tell us of them?
Well, this is, of course, a couple. They come together at a time when, you know, the Moors had run Spain for over 700 years. and they come together, they get married, and they...
I think the year, let's put a year to this, because I'd like
to make
sure...
Yeah, I think it was 1472, I believe, was the year that they were married. There's some dispute whether it was 1472 or even 1492, but I think 1492 is
it's
probably...
It's like 1469 was one date I saw, but it's like 1469, 1470, somewhere in there. So that's the year we're talking about.
But I think the two major things that you associate with them, I do think you're right. They're a very traditional marriage. I think more in line with, you don't have all the adventure and passion of Cleopatra and Antony. I mean, they're never going to make a movie like that about those two. But they had tremendous accomplishments. Number one, they pushed the Moors back south of Spain. And then, of course, they were the ones who, especially Isabella, was the one who believed in Columbus. I mean, and that faith changed the world as we know it. So in that respect, they stand out. But they really loved each other. I mean, every indication that we have, and of course, it's hard to come up with a lot of information because you just didn't have the same media back then that you do now. But
well,
all Sylvia, indications
before
that they
you,
were
before
very
you get on,
pretty
I'd
couple.
Like to interject a couple of things that
sure.
I found fascinating about Isabella doing
sure.
some of my own research.
Yes.
And one of it was she became Queen of Castile upon the death of her half-brother. But before he died, he kept on trying to marry her off to all sorts of different princes, one of France, another of the Habsburg. I mean, it went back and forth in the marriage negotiations three or four times. And he first proposed that she and Ferdinand married, then came back with several other suggestions. But in the end, she got her choice, and she ended up picking up Ferdinand. She was definitely in love with him at the start of their marriage. It definitely started out as a marriage of love, which was a great way. And the other thing about Columbus, they had a lot of battles with Portugal, their nearby neighbor. And as a result of the conflicts, there was compromise, an agreement that basically gave Portugal all the navigational rights and left essentially Aragon and Castile high and dry, which is why they sent Columbus on the mission.
Interesting. That's an interesting angle. I was not familiar with that, but they were, you know, they're the kind of couple, they're the couple associated with the beginning of the big Spanish empire, because it was because of Columbus and the discovery that Spain becomes an international superpower, international naval power. So they're the two associated with that. So when people talk about Spanish history and the great days of the Spanish Armada and all of that, so that's the couple associated with that. They were the couple that sort of put back or put Spain on top, I guess that would be my description. They were also a very good-looking couple. If you look at the pictures, and again, it's hard, we don't have pictures, we have paintings, but they were really a good-looking couple. She was a very good-looking lady.
Yeah, and apparently he was quite a dashing figure, which is why she fell in love with him at first sight, apparently.
Yeah. The paintings that we have of them, they're really a good-looking couple. I mean, if we could equate them to some modern day political figures, they would be like Mitt Romney and Ann Romney, a very good looking couple. That's what they would be compared to. But they were really a good looking couple. The paintings that we have would certainly confirm that. So I think that's a great choice, Isabella and Fernando. Those would be the way you say it in Spanish, Fernando and Isabella.
Eventually I'll learn. But let's turn now from one European couple, we're very traditional Catholics, who to another European couple who were not particularly traditional but made an indelible mark on Western Europe. And Barry, we're going to turn this one over to you because it involves an era that you love. And I would like to also point out that Barry is working on, I believe, a script or screenplay related to Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine. So, Barry, I'm going to turn this over to you now.
Well, thank you. But before I get there, I wanted to quote from Oscar Wilde, because Sylvia was talking about a love match, and this married couple was very much in love. And I just want to point out to people that I share Oscar Wilde's sentiment that you should always keep love in your heart, and that's why I don't believe in ever getting married. Okay, that's said.
Now, wait a second. Now, I would like to interject one point, again,
yes,
related to the couple we're about to discuss, Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine. And I was just discussing this with a girlfriend. Eleanor formed a court of love, and she would gather her ladies of the court, and they would hear a variety of romantic cases between men and women. And they concluded, based on this court of love, that love could not reside in marriage. So, not to put a kibosh in anybody's romantic Valentine's today, but it relates to the couple we're about to talk and agrees with the point Barry just made. So
can I just say one quick thing? Barry, can I just say one quick thing? After those two quotes, I can just picture a lot of women throwing back roses to their husbands who are listening to us tonight. All these women who are sitting there with their roses listening to us tonight going, oh, no, they're throwing them back. But anyway, go ahead, Barry.
Well, Eleanor would probably agree with, at least towards the end of her life, with that sentiment, because her husband ended up locking her away for 16 years in a prison just to keep her from causing trouble. But the marriage of the two goes back earlier than that, and it began actually on a happy note. But let me begin by introducing the characters. Henry II was, when she met him, the Duke of Anjou. I'm sorry, the Count of Anjou, and heir presumptive to the throne of England. And he was very young. He was 9 years younger than she was. He was a lad of about 18 or 19 years old. And she was anywhere from 28 to 30. Eleanor, on the other hand, was a very worldly woman who had already been married to the King of France. And we met her during the Crusades when we were talking about the Second Crusade. She was the wife of Louis the Pious, a husband who has spent more time on his knees than inside her bed, apparently, which is why, after some years of marriage and only two daughters, the marriage was annulled. And within weeks of the annulment, she married the very young and handsome Henry II, Plantagenet. Now, the Plantagenets were known as the Devil's Brood, and they can trace their lineage back to the daughter of the devil himself, a demon named Melisande. There's a long story about how the blood of the devil actually got into the family of the Plantagenets. But they were blessed and cursed with all those all the temperament of the devil. They were charming, they were handsome, they were violent, they were hot-tempered. They were quite a classic sort of movie family. If you think of medieval kings, you think of the Plantagenets. Tall, blonde, handsome, fiery-tempered. And of that line of kings comes some of the most celebrated medieval heroes, such as Richard the Lionheart, who was the son, in fact, of Henry and Eleanor. Also was the Black Prince, and Edward III, who won the Battle of Crecy, and his son, the Black Prince, who won the Battle of Poitiers against the French. Of course, there was also evil King John, who was personified the worst of the Plantagenets, the Devil's Brood. So Eleanor is divorced from her husband. She's the most beautiful woman in Europe, supposedly. She is definitely the most headstrong and willful of queens of France. She's the one who rode bare-breasted, apparently, after the Crusades, imitating Amazons of old. She divorces this pious, cold, unpassionate man, Louis Capet. And she marries Henry Plantagenet, a man, again, who is much younger than she is. And for the first few years, they have plenty of children. They have five sons, and they have a couple daughters. And they, between them, form the Plantagenet Empire, just out of their holdings that they inherit. She inherits the Duchy of Aquitaine, which is basically a mixture of Gascony and Bordeaux. She's also Countess of Poitiers in her own right. He, in turn, is Duke of Normandy, the Count of Anjou, ruler of Ireland, Brittany, and King of England. So between the two of them, they rule more France than does the King of France. And between them, they're the largest landowners in all of Europe. So they have this very tempestuous relationship. But as the boys grow up, the boys begin to exert their independence from their father, starting with young Henry, who is crowned co-king. And eventually they rebel against their father one after another. And Eleanor makes the mistake of siding with her son, first Henry, then later Richard, in various revolts against the father. And so defeated in the first rebellion, she's locked away for 16 years. And let out occasionally on holidays. And in fact, we see that in The Lion of Winter. She's let out to come have Christmas with the family. It's a great play and a wonderful movie with Katharine Hepburn playing Eleanor.
It's a good movie.
But they are the ultimate power couple, and their children are Richard the Lionheart and John, King John. Richard is the greatest warrior king of England, and John is the worst king of England. So they have that going for them.
Right.
And as Leslie mentions, she's a great patron of the arts. The troubadour culture of Southern Europe prospers under them. And they really advance the Middle Ages from the late Dark Ages into the High Middle Ages. So that's Henry and Eleanor.
Absolutely. Great couple. I'll tell you what we're going to do, guys. We're going to take a little break. We're going to hear from our sponsor for the next segment, which is Aaron Clary and the book Enjoy the Decline. So we're going to take a little break. And then when we come back, who are we talking about next, Leslie?
We are talking about Lord Nelson and Emma Hamilton.
All right. So that's a good one to look forward to. We're going to take a break. Leslie, stick with me. And we're going to take a break, and we're going to bring in our friend Aaron Clary. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and let's say hello to Aaron Clary. How are you, Aaron?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Absolutely great. Say hello to Leslie.
Happy Valentine's Day, Aaron.
Yes.
Hey, will you be my Valentine's Day, Leslie?
I would love it. In fact, you're the one who gave me my first formal Valentine's present last night by promising me to send me the book that signed, so I really appreciate that.
All right.
Oh wow. Oh, that's
now,
great.
Who's your
promises come for anything? We're in good hands.
That's right. Who is your power couple? If you had to pick a power couple from history, who would that be?
Oh, power couple. I don't know. I never thought about it. I would probably say Eisenhower and his wife. I don't even know who his wife was, but
Mimi.
She knows.
His wife was Mimi. Eisenhower.
Mimi Eisenhower. So,
yeah.
And she knew that he had an affair over in Europe, and she didn't give him no guff about it. Not that I'm kind of agreeing with that, but, you know, if you're trying to save the world and freedom and democracy, well, Mimi is truly a saint in that regard. So if you want to talk about a power couple, the Supreme Allied Commander and Mimi would be my vote.
Oh, right. And she, of course, became First Lady as well about 10 years later after D-Day. Well, tell us about this book, Enjoy the Decline.
Well, it's not a happy book, but it's an important book. I have many friends and loved ones and family members, you know, pretty much a conservative libertarian crowd. I see, you know, after the election of Barack Obama, a lot of them are depressed. They don't know what to do. What, you know, like, okay, what did I spend the past 30, 40 years of my life for? You know, we played by these certain rules that the United States was going to be free and that capitalism was going to remain. And the individual would be the building block of society, and that may not be the case anymore. And so a lot of them are starting to question what did they waste their lives for in the past and what's their future going to be like in the future. And so I wrote this book called Enjoy the Decline that addresses the concerns I think pretty much every conservative or libertarian in the United States has in terms of, okay, well, if the United States is going to go down the road of Europe and we're going to fail miserably and these debt problems, all these concerns, how do you exactly get joy and happiness out of it? And so this book addresses that. It is forthright. It says, hey, look, here's the reality. Here's the economic situation. This is, you know, I don't sugarcoat it at all. But at the same time, in addressing the truth, we can then therefore make a plan or a strategy that is based in the real world and therefore produces real results in practical help and advice that can help the average American loving, freedom loving, liberty loving American enjoy the most of their life.
You're sort of like giving people a map. You know, it's like a map of how to navigate through the next 4 years, I guess. That's kind of the idea that I'm getting out of it.
Right, yeah. No, actually, that's more succinct than I could have put it. Actually, you hit it right on the head. It's a map or a guideline on how to go and enjoy your life despite your society, your civilization declining in front of you.
So to make the best out of a bad situation, I guess another cliche that you might want to think about too, right?
Absolutely, you know, lemonade out of lemons, however you want to put it, but it really goes beyond like, well, geez, I went to the casino, I lost $50. I mean, this addresses people's livelihood because, you know, you live in the United States, you
That's right.
operated by these rules, so it really is more fundamental than that, and hopefully, especially as I intended it to be for some of my friends and families and loved ones, saying like, look, life ain't over because you've been given life. You know, God or whoever you want to believe in has given you a life. Please don't goof it up and don't let someone like Barack Obama ruin it for you.
That's
you know,
right.
You really ought to enjoy it. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And you can get the book at Amazon. I have a link to your book, which is available in print and Kindle. I have a link to Captain Capitalism on the show information. So that way people can look at both of your books, Worthless and also Enjoy the Decline. Thank you very much, Aaron, for joining us tonight.
All right, happy Valentine's Day, guys.
All right, we'll talk to you later. Aaron Cleary, the book Enjoy the Decline. Check it out. I think it's a great book. And the other book, too, Worthless, that we've been talking about, is also a very good book. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Happy Valentine's Day. We're talking tonight with Leslie Eastman and Barry Jacobson, and we're looking back at great couples in world history tonight on Valentine's Day. Leslie, who's next?
Well, I'm going to turn this again over to Barry, and he's going to discuss a real war hero, Lord Nelson, and his paramour, Emma Hamilton.
Yes, well, Aristotle said that love is composed of a single soul inhabiting two bodies. And I think that's a wonderful quote for Valentine's Day. And that's really what we have here with Lord Nelson, England's greatest naval hero, and the woman he loved, Lady Hamilton. And this relationship was quite scandalous. It was the greatest scandal, in fact, of its age, that age being the age of Napoleon. Just to give listeners some background, England was always a great naval power, and though it had a small, effective army, it was basically a naval power, and its fleet was the most celebrated in all the world. And during that age of the tall ships, or the sailing ships, no admiral was more celebrated than Horatio Nelson, later known as Lord Nelson. And he won his fame by defeating Napoleon's fleets at two particular battles. One was the Battle of the Nile in the 1798, and the other was the Battle of Trafalgar, where he lost his life in 1805. And in between those two dates, he had this illicit affair with a married woman whose name was Lady Hamilton, or Emma Hamilton. And he met her when he was on cruise in the Mediterranean as a young captain. He was still, well, several years before he became a hero. He was a 35-year-old captain, hadn't done very well so far in the service. He'd been on half pay for much of his career. And it was really only the outbreak of the Napoleonic Wars that gave him an opportunity to show his tactical brilliance in naval battles. But during that early years, in September of 1793, he had the chance to dock in Naples, where he met the wife of the British envoy. And her name, Emma Hamilton, Lady Hamilton, was quite a celebrated beauty. And she was also a model, an actress, and quite flamboyant.
Yeah, Barry, I'd like to point out just one thing before you go on. It's amazing how many of our characters will tie back to each other. One of the things she used to model was historic characters, and one of her favorite was Cleopatra.
Wow.
So please continue, Barry.
Cleopatra only suffers from being Egyptian, but that aside, she was quite an amazing woman.
I will slap you for that later, but please continue with
Yes. So anyway, Nelson was quite taken with her, and she was quite taken with him, but the relationship didn't begin until 5 years later, when, as the victor of the Battle of the Nile, he was in the Mediterranean once again, and she was still in Naples. And he conducted the evacuation of British nationals and the royal family from Naples as Napoleon's army was marching down through Italy, where Napoleon would soon put his brother-in-law, Marshal Murat, on the throne of Naples. And during that period, there developed a friendship between Nelson and Lord Hamilton, Emma's husband, which endured surprisingly throughout their entire relationship. The man was much older than Emma, and he turned a blind eye to their romance and seemed to, in fact, have approved of it. And the two of them began carrying on, and it soon became a public light and became quite a scandal. Now, the newspaper reading public loved it. It was salacious. They had their own version of the National Enquirer back then. And this couple was featured quite often on the cover of those rags. And eventually, after 2 years in Sicily with the couple, the Admiralty called them back to service. They were concerned that he actually was losing himself in this relationship. And by the way, he was married. And one of the things he did that was quite scandalous is when he got back to London, again, he was a hero at this point of the Battle of the Nile, where he destroyed Napoleon's fleet in the Mediterranean. He actually separated from his wife. It was not uncommon for great men to have mistresses. It was uncommon for them to leave their wives over those mistresses. So that also created scandal. And as he was returning to England, the three of them, the husband and Lady Hamilton and Lord Nelson, they traipsed through first Italy and then Austria and up through Germany and eventually to England, being celebrated throughout Europe. As they went, he was quite the hero to all the anti-Napoleon factions. And once they were in England, it was the same thing. Everywhere they went, there was a parade. And this went on for some years until eventually he was sent out to sea once again. And at the Battle of Trafalgar in 1806, he was killed by a musket ball. Of course, he famously said in his flags over his sails, which were signals to the rest of the fleet. Fleets in those days didn't have radios, of course, they signaled by flags. His remarks to his fleet on the eve of the battle was, England expects every man to do his duty. But he also sent a message to England itself saying that if he was not to survive this, they hoped they would take care of his mistress and, in fact, her young daughter that they just had, whose name was Horatia. And at the height of the battle, as he defeats the French Navy, decisively the French and Spanish Navy, a sniper on a mast of a French ship shoots him and breaks his back and kills Lord Nelson, who, by the way, by this point had lost both his eye and his arms in his previous battles. He was slowly being whittled away, which endeared him immensely to the British public.
Mm.
So he, sadly, after he died, England did not take care of his wife and daughter. She ended up deeply in debt, trying to take care of his captains and keep his name up and keep up the house that they had, and had millions of pounds in debt, and eventually was sent to a debtor's prison.
Wow.
His daughter, Horatia, went on to live a fairly happy life with many children and many grandchildren, but staying a very low profile, never quite trusting the press and the public again. So that's the story of the most scandalous couple of the early 19th century, the celebrated hero Horatio Nelson and Lady Hamilton.
Wow, that's fascinating. I didn't know that story. That's great knowledge. I guess we have time for a couple more, Leslie.
We're definitely gonna have one for we got to hit Juan and Eva Perón.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, we'll get to that. I just wanted to give you an idea of the time. So we got probably a couple more that we can do, and then if there's any that we left out, maybe we could just put them all together and just talk about them in about a minute or so.
No, so, that's okay. I think people can just go to my website and read it.
Okay, okay, good.
So, Juan and Eva Perón, definitely a dynamic couple.
Oh, gosh, without question. And of course, the most recent, which is what I found so interesting, they're the most recent of all the couples that you had looked at, right? I don't think of anybody
yes.
else that was more recent. I mean, this was the 1940s. She died in 1951, although Perón went on to have a career not as successful. But they were really an amazing couple. He was a military man who lost his first wife, some kind of cancer, I don't remember right now. And he was in his mid-40s. She was a very popular young woman in her mid-20s, late 20s. She was an actress. She was on the radio. She made movies. Not a big, big star, but, you know, pretty big. And she had a lot of problems with love. She had just had a lot of problems finding the right man, I guess. And they met, and it was chemistry from the very beginning, the two of them. For a while there, they lived together, but then that became a bit of a scandal. They actually did get married. He went on to become, to make a long story short, he went on to become president of Argentina, and she was probably the most incredible first lady, certainly in the Spanish-speaking world. There's been nobody like her. And when you think of when she was doing this, the only other comparison in the United States would have been Eleanor Roosevelt, and there's a big contrast between them because while Eleanor was a great woman and a great ally to President Roosevelt, Evita just had an amazing, that was her nickname, Evita. She just had an amazing connection with the people, and I think as she understood, and if people watch that movie Evita with Madonna, there's a great scene in the movie when they're showing her getting all dressed up and all of that, but I think she understood two things. Number one, she needed to support her husband because her husband really needed her. And the other thing she understood is that the people of Argentina, and I would think that was probably true of much of the Spanish-speaking world, they really wanted to have a fashionable, classy first lady. And, you know, so she just, you know, she would dress up very well. There's a History Channel one time ran a little thing about her, a biography about her, saying that her jewelry collection would match Cleopatra, again, going back to Cleopatra. But she was just an amazing woman, and she died young of cancer as well. And after she died, his political career really went down because she was the ultimate retail politician. She was fantastic. Had she been born, let's say, 30 or 40 years later, it's conceivable she could have been president herself. But at the time, it just wasn't going to be accepted by especially the military in Argentina to have a woman as commander-in-chief. But she was amazing, I tell you. And I would recommend this movie, Evita, that Madonna made. I'm not a big fan of Madonna, but that was a good movie, Leslie.
Yeah. Well, I was going to add just a couple of other fascinating tidbits from my reading of her. Of course, she was born poor. Her parents were not married, and father dumped the family. So she really focused on the poor, and part of her draw was making, you know, her husband appealing to the general population of Argentina. So that as part of it. Another aspect is that she did a goodwill tour in Europe that featured Spain. And going back to the first set of couples we talked to, one of her premier stops was the tomb of Isabella of Castile. So
right.
An interesting factoid there.
No, she's amazing. She's really an amazing woman. And while I politically would have probably disagreed with her because she was more of a center-left populist type of person, nevertheless, her incredible abilities at connecting, and especially connecting with women. She brought women into voting, and that was one of the big reasons that that Perón won, because he carried the woman vote, if I could put it that way.
Yeah.
But great personality.
Yeah. And as I like Halloween better than Valentine's Day, one last note, her body basically after the fall of Perón they took her body out of Argentina for a while, and we hid it in a tomb in Italy. And
yes.
It was basically returned to a shrine to her in 1971.
That's right. And when they opened, this is a little scary, but when they opened the casket, she was so preserved because they had, you know, it's just amazing. There's a tremendous personality cult around this woman. I'll just say that much.
Yes, it is, and definitely, it shows you how well they worked together as a couple, but how he was able to step aside and let her shine.
Oh, yes.
And how her light still shines for the people of South America.
Absolutely, absolutely, you're right about that. Who's the next one?
Well, talking about death and tombs, this brings me to the couple I'm going to discuss next.
All
because,
right.
As you well know, I am I dance Bollywood, and I love things that are Indian. And this is the story of Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal. Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal were just a love match. They were betrothed in 1607. So this is the year you were talking to. And Shah Jahan, before he became Shah Jahan, was a prince of the Mughal dynasty in India. And as he was the prince, he at 14, he saw Arjumand Banu Begum, a Persian noblewoman, in the marketplace and decided he had to have her as a wife. It was dynamic. It was instant. Love at first sight. But it took 5 years of negotiation before they were wed in 1612. And interestingly, the Mughals would take throne names upon their succession. And Shah Jahan means ruler of the world, so he changed his name. And Mumtaz Mahal means the chosen one of the palace. So royal names for a royal couple. And even though Shah Jahan had other women in his harem, as a Mughal ruler would, she was definitely his favorite. And that's a real challenge back in those days. She bore 14 children. The last one is the one that took her life. She died of complications related to childbirth. And he went into he forced the court into mourning for 2 years, and at that point decided to build an incredible tribute to his love for her. And he was at the height of the Mughal Empire. And this is the golden age of Mughal Indian art and architecture. And he took the best architects and he took the best materials. And he, for over 22 years, oversaw the construction of what we now know as the Taj Mahal. Taj Mahal is a fantastic tribute to love. And during that time, toward the end of his rule, he ruled until he was in his 70s, had issues with his son. It was rumored that he was intending to build a black version of the Taj Mahal, but really looking at the structure, what the black version turned out to be was a reflection of the white Taj Mahal in the adjacent reflecting pool. So that wasn't really true, but they thought of that. Anyway, they were going to have a grand ceremony upon Shah Jahan's death, but the son and he had conflicts. The son, being a traditional fundamentalist Muslim ruler, which did not appreciate Shah Jahan's more inclusive take of Hindu art and literature, so he basically slammed his father's bodies next to his wife's in the Taj Mahal. So that is the end to perhaps one of the most passionate romances that come out of that region of the world.
Well, I didn't know that one. This is one I learned again because of our show. That is an amazing story. But I thought, in the short time that we have, if you could just kind of give us a quick, who are some of the couples that didn't make the cut? I mean, bad couples. I'm not saying they're not important. We just didn't have time for them.
We didn't have time to cover them because I definitely wanted to have more material because
sure.
I didn't know how this would go. But
sure.
John and Abigail Adams.
Oh, yes. That would have been a great one. We'll talk about them sometime. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be a great,
and,
a great marriage.
And just a couple of points known to us through their love notes.
Yes.
And really, truly the founding couple. Abigail inspired John in so many ways and kept him going through some pretty dark times. And yet she promoted women's rights and was definitely one of the early voices against slavery in the country.
Absolutely. And one thing about and I recommend to anybody to go to the library or maybe buy it. I don't know if it's available for sale. It probably is. But in the library you can get some of their books, which is a compilation of their letters. And not only are their letters historical, they're very important to learn what was going on during that time. They're very romantic also.
Yeah.
I mean, they wrote some very romantic letters to each other, which I think is a credit to both. But I thought if we could just kind of go around and have everybody take a 30 seconds and talk about maybe what makes these couples special. These are very interesting couples, but they all seem to have chemistry, I guess. So, Barry, what do you think makes these couples interesting and so important?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's a matter of soulmates. What brings them together sometimes is ambition. In the case of political figures, almost always ambition. In fact, Lady Hamilton was probably the reason Lord Nelson became such a success.
Mm-hmm.
She really pushed his career and got him to stop being so shy and so afraid of the limelight. So I think it's political, but it's basically two souls who find each other, or as Aristotle would say, one soul inhabiting two bodies, and they fill out some other part of each other
right.
missing. I think that's the big part.
Yeah, I think so too. And Leslie, I'll give you a chance to say something, but I just want to say something about the two that I spoke about. You know, Kin, Ferdinand and Isabella, and Juan and Evita Perón. I think that in those two examples, they were clearly in love. I mean, I have no doubt. That they loved each other. Now, obviously, they were all very ambitious, and I mean, all of that is true. But I do think they loved each other. So I think Juan Perón was madly in love with Evita, and she was madly in love with him, and the same, I think, with the Spanish and the king and the queen. So, Leslie, you get to have the last 30 seconds to talk about these couples and what they meant to each other.
Well, I'm not putting any pressure on me, gentlemen, are you?
No, not at all.
And though I do love Halloween best, I better leave this on a positive note, given
sure.
our audience's Valentine's Day. But I think what draws us is every relationship, and we all know this, has its ups and downs. Yet for these couples, their ups and downs made part of their story special.
Right.
And they transcended their problems to impact history in some way that still holds meaning for us all, whether it's the court of love that Eleanor created, the dramatic suicide of Antony and Cleopatra, the astonishing support and willingness to you know, go through scandal that Emma and Lord Nelson experienced. You know, so many things that they had to go through that challenged them but still made them stronger and made them inspiring to people who are in love today.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. It's a great way to put it, great way to finish our Valentine's Day show. Barry, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I guess we're going to see you when again, Barry?
I believe we have a show next month, do we not, Leslie?
No, we have one. You have
on
the 20th of this month, so he's going to be back with us next week.
Next week, and give me a quick 30 seconds on that show.
Well, let's see, the 20th we are doing a show on Richard III, the last of the Plantagenets. And
so
this
is the connection connection to tonight, right?
Exactly. He was an ancestor of Henry II and Eleanor.
Great. All right. So we're going to get together next week. And what's the title of that one going to be, Leslie? Have you thought of that?
Richard III and the War of the Roses, right, Barry? Something along those lines?
Yes, you actually caught us a little flat-footed. We haven't come up with the exact name, but that's close enough.
So we'll just say that it'll be called The Thursday Show, and we'll fill in the blanks.
But it'll be very fascinating, especially with Barry's knowledge and perspective of this very interesting and dynamic time during the English history.
Well, with both of you...
Particularly because Richard III is one of the most vilified of all English kings.
Right.
Even worse than King John. So it'll be a fascinating show because we're going to try to show, among other things, that Richard might not be as guilty as people think.
That's interesting. Well, with you two, it's always going to be an interesting show. So I look forward to that next week. Barry, thank you so much. And congratulations to Leslie Eastman for putting this together, Leslie. This was absolutely great. I love it.
I'd like to thank Barry especially for a lot of these couple suggestions. And he is a big inspiration behind keeping my Halloween-like tendencies in check.
All right. Well, I tell you what. Since you're dressed as Cleopatra tonight, We're going to leave our show tonight with that great song by John Gilead called The Sands of Egypt. So good night, Goddess, and good night, Barry.